This is The Real Story from the BBC. I'm Rithula Shah with your weekly deep dive into a story that's making news and changing lives. And in an unusual move, the US government has begun 2021 by buying up nearly $3 billion worth of debt that the South American country of Ecuador owed to China. Now Ecuador's government owes the United States instead. It's the latest salvo in the battle for influence across Latin America, which over recent years has seen Beijing's clout when it comes to shaping the region's future grow.
In a major diplomatic victory for China, Panama has broken off its long-running alliance with Taiwan and established relations with Beijing.
The presidents of Panama and China have signed new trade and investment agreements.
President Juan Carlos Varela said that he aimed to consolidate Panama's role as China's gateway to Latin America.
There's growing economic influence too. Take Brazil. More than a quarter of its exports now go to China. Just 12% go to the United States. On the other hand, if you include Mexico and the Caribbean, the US remains the region's biggest trading partner and has given tens of billions in development aid and other support over the years. But the relationship, as Bolivia's Evo Morales points out, comes with historical baggage.
Latin American compatriots, we must recognize that the US beat us in Honduras. But the people of America won in Venezuela, Bolivia, and Ecuador. Countries have the right to decide for themselves about their own democracy.
Venezuelans are dignified people. The United States has set out to create a humanitarian crisis in order to justify a military intervention.
Reports revealing the wide extent of US surveillance in Brazil had already angered the government, but now new documents suggest that the president herself was under direct surveillance, with emails, phone calls, and text messages being monitored.
So, in the new battle for economic and political influence across Latin America, is China's rise set to continue? The United States is pushing governments across the world to reject Chinese infrastructure and information technology, systems that it claims represent a security risk. But unless that request is backed up with cold, hard cash, will warnings to South American capitals to steer clear of Beijing fall on deaf ears? Is China winning over Latin America? I'm imagining a thick rope laid across the region, South America, Latin America, with China pulling hard on one side and the United States heaving away with all its might on the other. To help us understand the forces at work in this contest, we're joined by Monica de Bol. She's a Brazilian economist and senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Welcome to The Real Story, Monica de Bol. Is there one instance that stuck in your mind that demonstrates China's increased influence in Central and South America, either economically or politically?
Actually, yes. And it's more of a personal story than anything else. So for some time, I was the director of the Latin American Studies program at SAIS, the School for Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And what I noticed over the years is that more and more Chinese students were coming into the program. And not only were they coming into the program, but they were coming into the program already with knowledge of Portuguese and Spanish, which was very striking, and quite good knowledge at that. So they were almost fluent speakers. And that jumped out at me as, you know, just the sheer importance for China of having greater influence in the region and also being able to actually understand locally what Latin America is like.
Fascinating. Let's hear next from Jorge Guajardo. He's a senior director at McClarty Associates, where he provides strategic counsel and expertise on Latin America and China. He served as Mexican ambassador to China from 2007 to 2013. Welcome to The Real Story. Is there an example for you that demonstrates China's increased influence in the region?
So my example was in the opposite direction, and it goes back to the time when I was serving as Mexico's ambassador to China. And one of the things that ambassadors usually have a hard time in China is getting meetings with high-level government officials. Unlike other countries in the world, China is not a country that allows access to its high-level government officials to foreign officials. And I recall one time when the group of Latin American and Caribbean ambassadors, we used to caucus, we called ourselves the GRULAC, a group of Latin American and Caribbean ambassadors, we got together and said, you know, none of us have had the opportunity to get together with the commerce minister. He won't see us on an individual basis. Why don't we get together as a group and request a meeting with him? And the dean of the group, which was a Colombian ambassador, took the request to the commerce minister. They took a while, and after 3 weeks, they came back to us and said that the commerce minister had no time to meet with us. So the commerce minister had no time to meet with the entire group of ambassadors from Latin American and Caribbean countries. That was a time when I realized that maybe we were not as important to them as we had figured or thought we were.
A very interesting counterweight. I think we'll explore that some more during the course of the programme. Let's meet our next panellist. Margaret Myers is director of the China and Latin American programme at the Inter-American Dialogue. Welcome to The Real Story, Margaret Myers. What for you is an example that illustrates China's rising influence or otherwise?
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, my example isn't so personal, but rather sort of looking at the trends in the region. And I think, you know, really since the genesis of the Belt and Road Initiative in 2013, we haven't necessarily seen an explosion of activity, but a real focusing of activity on a few strategic sectors in which, you know, U.S. and European and other companies tend to be heavily invested. And this suggests to me, you know, a sort of maturing of the relationship, as well as, you know, is very suggestive of China's own growth and upgrading of its economy. And we are indeed seeing, you know, some really competitive investments in, for example, technology, financial services, and a wide range of infrastructure, not just the sort of transport infrastructure that we typically hear about.
I'm going to ask you more about that in just a moment. Let's meet our fourth panellist. Dr. Sui Shoujun is director of the Center for Latin American Studies at Renmin University of China in Beijing. Welcome to The Real Story. Dr. Sui Shoujun, is there a deal or an event that for you illustrates China's deeper ties with the region?
Yes, I'm a professor at Renmin University of China. So in last 5 years, I can feel there's a lot of Latin American students that are coming to my university, not only to my university, but to other universities as well, to study degree program. Personally, I supervise students from Brazil, Panama, and also from Peru, other country as well. We have more and more Chinese company, they are going to Latin America. So they come to the professor expert for consultation, for some advice regarding how to access the region, how to invest in some Latin America country. You know, my university established a Spanish language department, I think 4 years ago. So you can see there are a lot of signs that show the relationship is booming.
Very interesting. So in a sense, that's the flip side of what Monica de Bol was describing. Very interesting. So we've got some examples there of how Chinese influence may be felt across the Latin American region. And it really may surprise people who are familiar with the traditional ties that there have been with America and Europe. Margaret Myers, give us a sense of when these deeper ties began. When did Beijing begin taking an interest in Latin America?
The China-Latin America relationship is really long-standing, right? I mean, it dates back many, many decades. There have been trade relations and all sorts of exchanges with countries for a number of years. But this sort of enhanced economic relationship that you're referring to really started around the mid-1990s when a couple of mining and oil state-owned enterprises invested in both Venezuela and Peru. And since then, often with the assistance of China's policy banks, China Development Bank and China Export-Import Bank, a range of Chinese companies operating often in the extractive sectors, but also in a number of other industries have entered the region and established a growing footprint.
And when you bring it sort of bang up to date, there's that traditional idea that this is perhaps about minerals and mining. But today, what are Latin American countries exporting and what are they buying back in return?
Yeah, I mean, the fundamentals of the trade relationship in particular have not changed all that significantly, right? You still have a situation in which Latin American countries are exporting primarily, you know, commodities, soy from Brazil, copper from Chile and Peru, oil from a range of major oil producing countries, and importing higher value-added goods. And these goods are indeed of increasingly high value. We're not talking about just textiles, shoes, things of that nature that China was exporting to the region a couple of decades ago, but increasingly high-tech equipment, Lenovo computers, ultra-high-voltage transmission lines, high-speed trains, construction equipment, Huawei headsets, you name it. And so this asymmetry is ever present and in fact is in many ways exacerbating.
And you've hinted at it already, but just to give us a quick thumbnail description, it's not just trade we're talking about, it's also investment. What do we mean by that?
Right, right. And the investment relationship, you know, really took off after the global financial crisis. A lot of what we saw in that sort of post-2008 period was mergers and acquisitions, a lot of, you know, buying of international assets or of Latin American company assets in a wide range of sectors. Again, as I noted, there continues to be a focus on extractive sectors, on construction companies. But increasingly, since the Belt and Road got going, really in 2013, we've seen growing interest, you know, in a much wider range of sectors, reflective of China's capacity in all of these industries, right? We're seeing rapid growth in the tech industry in China, rapid growth in sort of technologies in terms of electricity transmission and distribution. And a lot of these technologies are being used obviously at home in China, but also are transferring to the Latin American context and to a wide range of other regions across the world.
Shui Shoujun, how would you describe China's interest in Latin America? How is it diversifying?
Since the China accession to the WTO and China developed an interest in Latin America, the fast-growing China's economy needs a lot of resources. China produces a lot of commodity, a lot of manufacturing product, and we hope can sell to Latin America. In 2013, China put forward a very audacious Belt Road Initiative, and Latin America is regarded as a natural extension of the Belt Road Initiative. In the meanwhile, you see a booming trade relation between China and Latin America. For example, China became Brazil's largest trading partner since 2009, replaced the United States. In the meanwhile, as Monica also mentioned, with China, we have a very powerful financial vehicle, that is China Development Bank. So the Development Bank of China provides a lot of capitals.
And how does that Chinese investment work? Is money handed over, or are Chinese contractors ultimately and workers directly involved in the projects? Is it Chinese firms that do the work?
There are different kinds of investment, include FDI, that is foreign direct investment. But it also means that China uses some creative approach. For example, in Venezuela, you can see the CDB, China Development Bank, give capitals to Venezuela to boost the oil extraction program. Venezuela pay back by the oil. So we call that loan for oil models. This is a very creative way to boost the economic cooperation between the two countries.
Jorge Guajardo, you're skeptical about how deep these ties are, but do you accept that they've certainly got stronger?
Probably stronger. I don't know. I don't necessarily accept that. I think there's just a confusion in the way we see Chinese incursion in Latin America versus other countries in the world. So, for instance, we refer to Chinese investment in infrastructure. Well, that's kind of confusing because the Chinese are not investing in infrastructure. That is to say, they're not assuming the ownership and the risk. They're just providing loans to governments that had no access to the multinational financial system to build roads, mostly with Chinese engineering and in cases with Chinese labor. So when Brazil, through Odebrecht, was making infrastructure projects all over Latin America, nobody was saying that Brazil was taking over Mexico or that Brazil was taking over Venezuela or any other country where Odebrecht was saying. The same with Iberdrola from Spain. Nobody says that Spain is taking over Mexico because they have Iberdrola infrastructure projects. But somehow we assume that because the Chinese incur in investment projects, again, which are just loans to the host government to purchase Chinese goods, because the Chinese Development Bank, as the name implies, is for the development of China, not for the development of Latin America.
But do you think that sort of increased debt to China influences how governments and companies work and operate?
I don't. It might a little bit, but I think a country's dependence on Chinese markets influences much more how that country works and operates towards China than receiving investment or loans from China.
Monica de Bol, would you agree?
Yeah, I fully agree, actually, because when we talk about investment, we're talking about countries or companies or whatever actually taking stakes and bringing the risk upon themselves. And that is not what we see happening in a lot of these projects in Latin America specifically. We see loans, and loans are a different thing. However, that being said, you know, when you look at Brazil, for example, Brazil has a very big financial sector. Obviously, it's Latin America's largest economy. China has actually been able to buy medium-sized banks. It hasn't entered the large bank segment, but it has certainly entered the middle-sized segment in the Brazilian financial sector, which is quite striking because Brazil is a very closed country when it comes to allowing foreigners into its financial sector. Sure, Santander has been operating in Brazil for a long time, but then again, that's true of all of Latin America. But with respect to other countries, even with respect to the U.S., it's very hard to get a banking license to operate in Brazil, and yet the Chinese have been able to do that. So you see very clearly how Chinese influence has grown in the region. And this is all very, very recent.
I just want to go back to one inflection point, which perhaps you'll disagree with, which is 2008. And I wonder if the financial crisis of 2008 helped to supercharge that trend of China's interest and influence across the region. There was, of course, a recession after that financial crisis in Europe and America, as the BBC's Brian Hanrahan found out in December 2008 when he filed this report from Chile.
It's a Sunday afternoon and Norman Vilches is out shopping for a new car. He's an engineer and his eye has been caught by Great Wall cars, the Chinese brand rapidly establishing themselves in Chile. That's hardly surprising. They're about $5,000 cheaper than their competitors, and Norman reckons they're good value.
The prices are very attractive.
It's a new thing, the Chinese selling cars here.
Yeah, very, very new. I think a couple of years ago is a good opportunity for the price.
With no local car industry, Chile imports from all over the world. But it's increasingly to the Pacific rather than older markets in Europe and the United States that it now looks. High in the mountains is where Chile mines copper, the foundation of the country's economy. As the ore is carried away down the mountains, a steady supply of goods is coming back across the Pacific. Recession in Europe and the United States has wrecked this year's budget by sending the copper price down. But Chile believes its new trading links with Asia will protect it from the worst of the crisis.
We have trade accords with almost every major economy in the Asia-Pacific region, and that is the region of the world that is expected to grow the most next year, and that will be a source of dynamism for our exports and therefore for our economy as a whole.
Down on the coast, the smelted copper waits to be shipped. The port is growing capacity by installing bigger cranes to turn ships round faster. And the cranes are built in China.
That's the late, great Brian Hanrahan reporting from Chile back in 2008. Monica DeBol, was 2008 a moment when perhaps the US was no longer seen as a reliable partner?
I'm not sure that I would put it exactly that way, but it was certainly a moment that changed relationships quite substantially. On the one hand, because a lot of Latin American countries had no other choice but to rely on China and China's buying of commodities produced in Latin America to sustain growth and to sustain themselves. So because China was not very much hit by the 2008 global financial crisis, and because it also put in place massive economic stimulus policies, this ended up creating the right conditions for many Latin American countries in terms of increased demand for commodities from the region. And that had a huge impact in the very sort of shallow recessions that we saw in many countries across Latin America. So it was a global crisis in scale, and yet Latin American countries, which used to be very much hit by global financial crises and would go into deep recessions and then would develop problems of their own, managed to sort of escape these problems in 2009 and 2010, largely because of China, because of, you know, just the way that the trade relationship then evolved, I think, in a very discontinuous way. There was a jump in that relationship, which helped many countries.
Jorge, do you think that there was an inflection point of sorts then?
I think it was definitely an inflection point, and I fully agree with what Monica is saying. I think there was a big inflection point, and that is the Chinese government became much more arrogant after 2008 and much more difficult to deal with. So I'll give you a quick example of my experience, and I was serving as Mexico's ambassador at the time. And it used to be when I first arrived that I talked to Chinese media, which are all state-owned media. And at the end of each interview, the interviewer would always ask me, what does China have to learn from Mexico? And it was just a humbling question. Of course, the assumption is not much, but we were both developing countries that we could learn from each other. Past 2008, that tone changed drastically. And at the end of every interview, the question would be, what can Mexico learn from China? And I think that started what ended up being the current wolf warrior diplomacy, in which China is just assuming that we're all inferior towards them. So diplomatically and politically, after 2008, it became much more difficult to deal with China. And if you see politically, you can see a trend after 2008 where there was a switch with Latin American countries. For instance, Lula in Brazil, who was very close, very keen to China. And then after 2008, in comes Dilma Rousseff, and she starts putting some distance and leading up to Bolsonaro, who is, of course, wanting to kick him out of the country. So I think the inflection point was 2008, when China just assumed it had nothing to learn from the world and it had everything to teach to the world.
Sui Shoujun, I'm going to let you answer that. Would you agree?
My colleagues seem to be very critical of China. I think China and Latin America are complementary to each other. If you look at the data, so from 2000 to 2019, so in about 20 years, China invested around 500 projects in Latin America for FDI. So I think China treats Latin America as an equal partner compared with their last century, because last century, Latin America is not on China's radar. So after 2008, with the economic rise of China, China feel it is time to engage with the region. But you know, as a Chinese, we don't have much knowledge on the region. I'm a professor, but even you know, people like me, we are learning to dealing with Latin America. In the China Ministry of Foreign Affairs, 10 years ago, there's a very small group of diplomats. They are working in Latin America. If you look at the figure of the staff dealing with Latin America, they are expanding very fast. I understand there's some complaining from a Latin America colleague, but if you look at how China adapt itself to the region, you can feel that China have some sincerities to dealing with the region.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a moment. But first, a quick reminder that if you have a look back in our podcast feed, you'll find our discussion last week exploring the upcoming deadline for all US troops to withdraw from Afghanistan. American forces have been fighting in the country for almost 20 years, having gone in shortly after the attacks of 9/11. The aim was to root out the Al-Qaeda extremists, but since then, the Taliban, which ruled the country, has proven to be a persistent adversary. President Trump struck up a deal a year ago, exchanging the withdrawal of US forces for a curb on violence. So has that agreement been met? And should President Biden abide by the decision to pull out or commit to what critics describe as endless foreign wars? And remember, if you're new to the podcast, do subscribe to the feed so you'll get us every week. But back now to the rise of Chinese influence across much of Latin America. I'm joined by the Brazilian economist Monica de Bol, by Jorge Guajardo, a former Mexican ambassador to China. Margaret Myers is director of the China and Latin American program at the Inter-American Dialogue. And Dr. Sui Shoujun is from Renmin University of China in Beijing. Earlier in the program, we got a sense of how the relationship between countries across the region and China has changed and has grown in terms of trade and investment. I want to think a bit more about the political implications. Let's begin, if we may, Margaret Myers, by thinking about Taiwan. How does the recognition of Taiwan, which sees itself as independent and China regards as a rebel region that's part of the motherland, how does that fare when you see Chinese influence?
Well, I mean, I think Taiwan, as in other regions, you know, factors quite prominently in terms of China's interest in engaging. Interestingly, I mean, and this is different from other regions, the Latin American and Caribbean region has been something of a stronghold for Taiwan with, you know, upwards at times of 12 or more allies in the region. Most of them focus in Central America and the Caribbean. But over time, you know, initially around 2010, we saw Costa Rica cut ties with Taiwan and establish them with mainland China. And then more recently, just in the past few years, around 2017 and 2018, we saw three other countries. First, Panama, then Dominican Republic, then El Salvador cut ties with Taiwan. The countries that tend to align diplomatically with China in some cases may very well support China's agenda in international organizations, whether on questions such as, you know, human rights or Hong Kong or on internet governance or any other number of issues. But often, at least historically, there's not been a very clear alignment in terms of voting between countries in which China is engaged or even engaged extensively economically. More recently, though, we have seen some activity in support, Caribbean activity in particular, in support of certain Chinese political decisions and specifically in support of the Hong Kong security law.
It's fascinating. So we've established to some extent that China has some interest in the region. It's trading more, it's investing, giving loans, to pick up on Jorge's point. But the other half of this conversation, the obvious other half, which to some extent we've set to one side mostly, is how this is all perceived by the United States. And I want to bring in Evan Ellis. He's professor with the US Army War College and a former member of the Latin America policy planning team under the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Welcome, Evan Ellis, to The Real Story. Why should any of this matter to the US in policy terms? How is it affecting the broader US agenda?
I would argue that China is not seeking to impose a Soviet-style political military model on the rest of the world. I think that's oftentimes a false argument that's used to say there's no problem here. What's happening, though, as China's economic influence, both in trade and also in investment terms, increases, is it's undermining traditional democratic institutions and human rights and, frankly, the types of rule of law-based transparent interactions that we'd like to see. You can see it, for example, in Venezuela, where $64 billion of Chinese loans and other support over the past 15-plus years had sustained Chavez and Maduro far beyond where market forces would have otherwise pushed him down. You saw it with the loans to Ecuador. You saw it with the trajectory of the Bolivian regime. And frankly, you see it in the increasing ability of the Chinese option undermining the interest of other regimes in going along with basically good policy prescriptions with respect to transparency and financial governance and things like that.
But some might compare this Chinese influence in the region to what the US has done for years. I mean, think back to the 1980s when Ronald Reagan backed the Contra forces against Nicaragua's Sandinistas, or the support for efforts to suppress the left in Argentina and Chile in the 1970s. I mean, don't big powers come in and try and have their say? Don't they meddle? Isn't that what the US has done?
Well, the U.S. has certainly made a share of mistakes and has behaved with an amount of hubris in Latin America and the Caribbean historically. But I think one of the problems right now is the drawing of some sort of moral equivalence between what the U.S. is trying to do, which oftentimes has also been an advocate for human rights and democracy and financial transparency and rule of law. China is not trying to reimpose a political model. It's very clear about that. But rather, in pursuing its own economic interests, it is indirectly silencing those who would speak out against certain issues, as Margaret alluded to with respect to Hong Kong. It's augmenting corruption, not because the Chinese state promotes corruption, but because the Chinese state oftentimes permits the corrupt actions of its individual enemies. And frankly, because as we move into spaces, for example, in the Caribbean and Central America, you have the undercutting of allies such as Taiwan, and you have really the reorientation of an entire generation of Latin American leadership.
Is the difficulty, though, for the United States that China always stresses non-intervention, this idea that it's not going to get involved? It's involved, interested in trade and investment, whatever, but it's not really interested in how you run your country. And we can debate whether or not that's true and whether there are other ways of influencing that. But that's certainly the rhetoric. But many countries may take that at face value and say, well, a more hands-off Chinese approach is actually rather preferable to the US effort or a European effort, which may come with strings attached.
That is part of the problem, but not often in the way in which it's deployed in Latin America. Certainly, China creates an ability for leaders, oftentimes making questionable decisions, and particularly authoritarian leaders, to continue to do what they would like to do. For example, in the case of Ecuador, you had Rafael Correa with about $17 billion of Chinese financing, both through the Ministry of Finance and on specific projects, really allowing a just raft of corrupt projects that when Lenin Moreno came in Ecuador, he was trying desperately to undo or at least sort out those ties of corruption. And so, sure, if you are a leader who is involved in benefiting from those projects, you're more than happy to say, hey, you know, we don't have anyone to tell us to be financially transparent or responsible. And there's a downside to that as well, but oftentimes the downside is not find the deals.
You're presenting this in terms which really stress anti-corruption measures, promoting human rights, democracy, and so on. But is there a perception that under President Trump that US policy was perhaps sometimes driven by a desire to contain China rather than actually about supporting or advancing the interests of the region itself?
Well, certainly with the 2017 National Security Strategy, you had a recognition of both China and Russia as competitors, not enemies, but competitors. And I think that was an important change in focus. And so with that focus, what you had was our Secretary of State, first Rex Tillerson, and then Mike Pompeo, as well as other leaders, really trying to reach out to the region to emphasize some of the risks of doing business with China. But those risks and the emphasis on those risks are in part because the United States is intimately tied in terms of our security, in terms of our immigration. The fact that immigration policy was such a significant policy under President Trump, I think, shows the degree to which what happens in Latin America affects the United States, even to the point of being a domestic issue, far more than it affects China.
Evan Ellis, stay with us. I want to bring in the other panelists and do join in this conversation, but I'd like to get some of their thoughts on what you've been saying. Jorge Guajardo, there is a new president now. If you accept some of what's been said, what would you like Joe Biden to do? Should he take a different approach?
So you'll notice that surprisingly, probably Latin American leaders were the regional leaders of the world that most liked President Trump. And the reason was because President Trump was pretty much acting like the Chinese government would. That is to say, he would not meddle. He would not mind if a country was corrupt, if a country was anti-democratic, if a country curtailed the freedom of speech. He didn't care. So in that sense, he was acting very much like a Chinese leader would in their approach to Latin America. So it's a case in which the leaders like the presidents, the people not as much. In comes a Biden administration, which is much more concerned on issues that may be difficult for leaders, transparency, freedom of speech, democracy, civil society, etc. And those are issues that are uncomfortable to the leader, not to the people. The people actually appreciate it. So that's why you see a lot of Latin American countries sort of pushing back on a President Biden. We've seen it very clearly in Mexico. We've seen it somewhat in Brazil. They're sort of saying, no, don't think you're going to come into my country. Because the fact is the leaders feel threatened by the way he will signal them out for doing the things that they shouldn't be doing.
So, Shujun, what's likely to change from China's perspective now that there's a new U.S. president?
As a Chinese, we hope that China and the U.S., we can reset the relationship, at least to resume dialogue. Because under Obama administration, China and the U.S., we have a strategic economical dialogue mechanism. That means the two countries' leaders, they can meet frequently to discuss international issues and to exchange ideas and to avoid mutual misperception. Regarding Latin America, I think China will do what it is doing during the last 10 years, continue its engagement with the region, regardless who is the president of the United States, as a business as usual.
Well, let's take a specific example of something that may change. Joe Biden's already signed a series of executive orders to tackle climate change, which he's described as an existential threat. And in the first presidential debate, when he was then candidate Biden, he warned Brazil of economic consequences if it didn't stop the deforestation of the Amazon.
Brazil, the rainforests of Brazil are being torn down, are being ripped down. More carbon is absorbed in that rainforest than every bit of carbon that's emitted in the United States. I would be gathering up and making sure we had the countries of the world coming up with $20 billion and say, here's $20 billion, stop tearing down the forest.
It's really interesting. In response to that comment, President Bolsonaro of Brazil lashed out at Joe Biden. On his Facebook page, he wrote that he doesn't respond to coward threats. Monica de Bol, how do you go forward from this? Is it going to have to be a carrot and stick approach when it comes to climate change? Or actually, is the United States, is this an example where perhaps it needs to collaborate with China if it's going to make a difference?
Well, I think collaboration would be very important, but I do see a collision course here between the U.S. and Brazil. And what has been happening is that with the environmental policies or the non-environmental policies under President Bolsonaro, deforestation has really ticked up very substantially since 2019. 2020 was horrendous. The world didn't pay much attention to it because, of course, we're in the middle of a pandemic. But in any case, Bolsonaro has basically dismantled the entire capacity of Brazilian agencies to monitor, supervise, and act against by penalizing deforestation. And I think
so
this is
going to come up as a question. So if you're Joe Biden and you want to change that behavior, is it with the cooperation of China then, if it can have an influence as a trading partner, as Brazil's main trading partner, if it can have an influence?
Well, it would be very important if China did join the U.S. in that effort, because I certainly think that a collaborative effort between the U.S. and China, being Brazil's two major trading partners and the two countries that actually Brazil does a lot of business with, for the business community, it would be very important to see that collaboration, because it would give them the opportunity to pressure the Bolsonaro administration, which is something that they've been trying to do but have not been as able to do because they haven't had the backing.
Evan Ellis, is this an example where the new administration, given its commitment to climate change, is going to have to take a very different tack to that taken by the Trump administration?
This is an excellent point, and I think really illustrates the dilemmas that the incoming Biden administration faces. On the one hand, recognizing that they bring in an enormous amount of sophistication, the experience of people like Anthony Blinken and Jake Sullivan, and really the opportunity to rebrand the United States and help reconstitute some of the U.S. soft power and influence through things like rejoining the climate agreement. And at the same time, it also illustrates the way in which some of the things that the administration may want to do in the region can undercut the U.S. position with respect China. So, for example, if there is a worsening relationship with Jair Bolsonaro, whether to what extent that could undermine U.S. attempts to dissuade Brazil from bringing in Huawei on 5G, or in other areas, for example, U.S. human rights and other pressures on governments in Honduras and Guatemala, whether that could tempt to say, instead of depending so much on the U.S., we really need to turn to the PRC rather than Taiwan, or frankly, even with softening policies on Cuba and Venezuela, remembering that in 2014 with Barack Obama, that actually substantially increased Chinese economic influence in Cuba when they thought they would have access to the U.S. markets through Mariel. So I think there's a lot of possibilities for U.S.-China collaboration. I certainly agree with my friend Professor Shui that things like the reconstitution of the U.S.-China Strategic and Economic Dialogue Latin America chapter would be very valuable.
Margaret Myers, if I can bring you in, just to pick up on something that Evan Ellis mentioned there and earlier too, which is the example of Huawei and 5G technology, something that the Trump administration was very opposed to, the introduction of Chinese technology, particularly into these 5G internet networks. Is it actually going to be an issue on which countries are going to be forced to take sides, where the United States is actually going to say, if you want to be on our side, you can't have this stuff?
You know, I think there are going to be continued incentives, right, or an effort to work together with other countries, with countries that are sort of like-minded in this respect, to try and incentivize choices in Latin America and other regions with respect to 5G and Huawei's participation in 5G auctions. And we've seen this play out, you know, very clearly under the Trump administration in the case of Brazil. But it's been, you know, I think largely, and Evan may disagree with me on this, a sort of losing battle. The U.S. and Japan, frankly, and Brazil have worked together on a number of trilateral initiatives to try to ensure cooperation in tech and in other areas, potentially, you know, at the expense of Chinese involvement. And yet we still see Bolsonaro suggesting that Huawei will be able to participate in upcoming 5G auctions, perhaps using that as something of a political bargaining tool, you know, as in anticipation of a more contentious Biden-Bolsonaro relationship.
Jorge Guajardo, how do you think that might play out?
I agree that this Huawei case is a case in which China is sort of making inroads in Latin America. I think the Trump administration, in its approach to Huawei's 5G, was sort of acting very much like the Chinese Communist Party does when it approaches other countries, which is brute force without regard to other countries' history. So, for instance, here you had the Trump administration warning Latin American countries or European countries, for that matter, that Huawei may be compromised and that it might threaten their country's security. This coming after the Snowden revelations, WikiLeaks, where most every leader in the region found out that the United States was spying on them, that the United States was listening on them. So there's not much trust in the United States system versus the Chinese system. So I would give you the point of view in Mexico is we know the United States spies on us, and maybe the Chinese do as well. So we're just going to go for the best price.
So Evan Ellis, if you've lost the battle of trust, then actually, if you're buying this technology from the cheapest seller, and the technology comes with perhaps surveillance capacities that you didn't necessarily expect, but they kind of come as part and parcel of it, doesn't that have an appeal? And doesn't it also undermine the democratic message that the United States would also want to reinforce?
First of all, I'm not sure that I would say that the U.S. has lost the battle of trust. I think the U.S. brand has been damaged by the past 4 years, but I think certainly there's possibilities to rebuild that trust through the type of engagement that we're seeing right now. But what you also say is important, which is what are the decisions that Latin America and other states make with respect to their architectures, not only in terms of how they expose themselves through what the Chinese government has demonstrated legal access to do through its 2017 national security law, but also the type of architectures where, like ECU 911 or POL 110 or some of these others that we're seeing, you know, do you start moving toward a place where your leaders and potentially authoritarian leaders have the ability to do things like what China is doing with its social credit system to decide whether people who are not cooperating with the regime can get on trains and do things economically? And so we already saw this with the Carne de la Patria in Venezuela, as well as the denoted actions of CEIC in going after the Venezuelan opposition to Juan Guaido. And so there's really a question of whether Latin America wants to sign up for architectures that, given the problems it's already had with authoritarianism, with the help of Chinese funding, basically empower farther authoritarian friends of China.
And Sui Shoujun, do you think that China inevitably, if it may be winning the battle to put in place its technology and is selling more goods and so on, can it ever win the battle of soft power? Isn't the United States ultimately just a much more attractive option in South America?
There's a rise of Chinese technology company in the last 10 years. Those companies, they want to be a global company, and they have a strong interest in country like Brazil or any other Latin America country. I think Chinese technology, they are cheap and effective, and also they are safe. There's some concern raised by colleagues, but there are a lot of solutions for those, you know, suspension on Chinese technology. So we can make the technology more transparent or cooperating with a local company. And in this way, make the local people trust the Chinese technology. So different countries have different choice. And, you know, Huawei is welcomed by certain group of countries, but maybe not by others. Regarding the soft power, I think we can see a rise of Chinese soft power in Latin America, because 10 years ago, 20 years ago, there's no technology company or no Chinese technology company present in the region. But nowadays, you can see a lot of them.
I just wonder then, we're about to wrap up, we're sort of running out of time, there's so much more I'd like to talk to you about, but if I can come to you first, Sui Shoujun, when you then look at the trajectory across the next decade, do you see China's influence across the region growing?
Yes, definitely, because soft power is a mirror of hard power. So you see China economic is the central of China hard power. A rise of hard power definitely will follow by rise of the soft power. There's a lot of example from United States and from UK or other countries in the world. So definitely, if you look at the trajectory, I think China's influence in the region will be stronger and stronger.
Jorge Guajardo, I know you would dispute that description, but even if it's partially true, and there certainly has been a change in that relationship, does it mean the US battle, if you like, for democracy, human rights, all those kind of bigger ideas, is also one that is on the wane, is being lost?
So let me just go back and rephrase it another way. I think there is nothing soft about Chinese Communist Party power projected abroad. There's nothing soft about it. There might be a growing presence and a growing influence in Latin America of China until Latin American countries get to know China better, and then there will be a big break and a big distancing. That's what's happened sort of in Brazil. You start seeing presidents campaigning on a platform of distancing their countries from China. So yes, there will be a growing presence as long as there is ignorance or lack of understanding in these countries of what China represents to them. And then as the more they get to know China, the more they will push themselves away and probably realign themselves with the United States.
Margaret Myers, do you think that's how it may pan out?
Well, I mean, just sort of hearkening back to our discussion on investment, I would politely disagree with a couple of the comments that were made that we are, in fact, seeing a lot of investment in the region, especially in terms of mergers and acquisitions, but also public-private partnerships, a lot of greenfield investment, building a lot of things. And that's going to continue. Chinese companies are very well positioned, economically speaking, especially in comparison to their peers at the moment, to do these things and indeed have expressed interest in a wide range of sectors, be it electricity transmission, hydropower, really, you name it. But, you know, my view in terms of the future and how Latin American countries will respond is that economic interest, especially at this juncture, will supersede sort of values-based ones. And so although there may be a sort of an awakening, right, and growing concern potentially about some of the activity that China is doing in Latin America, there is so much need for infrastructure and a wide range of other services, technology, and otherwise that, and often China is the only bidder in some of these projects. Whether they should advance or not is another question, right? But they're the only ones there. And so I do think we'll see more growth.
And do you think that US taxpayers, if they feel that this is imbalanced, may be interested in spending more of their dollars to maintain that relationship?
There hasn't been tremendous opposition to date. And indeed, when you look at the polls, U.S. impressions just among general people of China, that those views have deteriorated remarkably over the past just 4 years, coincidentally. So, you know, I do think there is a lot of concern, about a wide range of topics, some of it perhaps warranted, some of it perhaps not, in the U.S. And this view of U.S.-China strategic competition really isn't going anywhere, whether we're talking about a Biden administration or otherwise.
Evan Ellis, then throw forward to the next 10 years, looking across the region, should the U.S. be fearful of losing the battle for democracy? Should it be fearful of losing its influence?
Well, first of all, I agree with my friend Margaret with respect to ultimately economic interest trumping over political and other self-interest, as well as feeling a bit chilled with my friend and colleague, Professor Shui, said about the Chinese soft power in Latin America expanding with increasing Chinese hard power. What you do see, and also agreeing with Margaret and others, you've already seen about $123 billion in extractive industry investments, but you're also seeing increasing Chinese participation on the ground, whether it's Bogota Metro or the North-South Highway in Jamaica, or even control possibly by Shanghai dredging over the Paraguay-Paraná River corridor, which would give it control over the export corridor of five nation soy exports, or ports in Brazil such as São Luís, or increasingly the tens of billions in the electricity sector. And so with the economic influence, I fear that Margaret is right, that little by little, that web of self-interest, the desire to get the money and thus remain silent on some of the worries, whether it's the imprisonment of 2 million Uyghurs in Xinjiang or whether it's the record in Hong Kong and the suppression democracy movement, that little by little, the allies of Latin America's own self-interest in putting together a coherent Latin American stance are losing out to those who little by little want to not to put their own economic self-interest in jeopardy. For the U.S., again, we are intimately tied in terms of trade and investment to Latin America. And so I think this is the challenge for the United States, both Latin America and globally, dealing with China in a way of friendly competition, while at the same time preserving conditions which are win-win for the U.S. and the United States in the region that we all share.
Monica DeBolle, last word. How do you see this relationship playing out?
Well, I think there's one issue that we didn't touch upon, and it's quite a critical one for many countries in the region at the moment. We are in the middle of a mass vaccination campaign across most of the world. And as it turns out, in a lot of countries in Latin America, the one vaccine that is available, this is certainly the case in Brazil, where there are only two vaccines available, is a vaccine produced by Sinovac, Chinese laboratory, in cooperation with with other laboratories and health agencies in many parts of the region. In Brazil, that vaccine is CoronaVac, and it is the one expectation that Brazil has of having some chance of fighting the pandemic. So I think there is a dimension, there's a public health dimension to geopolitics and to the interplay between U.S., China, and Latin American relationships that we really need to consider and think about, because this issue is going to be with us for a while. And for the moment, many countries in the region are heavily relying on China for the production and the availability of these vaccines.
An interesting, fascinating thought, and I suspect one for a whole other program. We're going to have to leave it there. That's it for this week on The Real Story. Thank you very much to all our guests, to Monica de Bol, to Jorge Guajardo, to Margaret Myers, to Sui Shou Jun, and to Evan Ellis. If you have any suggestions for future deep dive topics you think we should cover on the program, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Rittler. But from me this week and the whole team, that's The Real Story. Thank you for your company, and do join us again next time.